Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
I was a Boston PD cop, and now I believe Yes on 4 is a smart choice to protect families.
Question 4 would allow thousands of pot shops and marijuana operators throughout Massachusetts.
You've seen the glut of TV ads for the Massachusetts ballot questions. John Carroll pulls back the curtain on who's paying for them. We'll also fact-check the Question 4 ads with Dr. Kevin Hill. Also today, a longtime political observer wonders if Democrats have truly become the party of the professional elite. And
we regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
Munich, 1938. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty's new play reimagines the historic meeting between Adolf Hitler and Neville Chamberlain. That's next on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just under 3 weeks to go until Election Day, everyone, and the advertising air war is escalating in Massachusetts, specifically over two of the state's ballot questions. This week, opponents of marijuana legalization launched their first television ad against Question 4. And with Question 2 and charter school expansion, well, that has the distinction of being the single most expensively fought advertising battle of any referendum in any state this election cycle, a total of $18.5 million spent so far, according to the Center for Public Integrity. Here's a taste of advertising from both sides.
We have a proven record of helping students in underperforming areas succeed.
Question 2 will expand charter school access and result in more funding for public education.
$400 million. That's how much charter schools will drain from Massachusetts public schools this year. $400 million siphoned from local districts that desperately need it.
Well, joining us now to dig into who's making these ads, who's paying for them, and whether or not ballot question advertising even works is John Carroll, professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. Good to see you, John.
Good to be here.
Okay, so first of all, let's just start with question 2 in charter schools. Super contentious issue here in Massachusetts. We just heard two clips there. They are from ads that were actually first put out back in August when
right.
A lot of people weren't paying attention. So what have we seen?
But they were spending a lot of money in August. Between them, they spent $3 million in August, which is a staggering amount for a time when nobody's paying attention. But it was sort of a harbinger of what was going to happen. So the pro-charter school ads are coming largely from a group of hedge fund managers who are based in New York and who have funded about half of this campaign. And they estimated they were going to raise $18 million alone by themselves.
Huh, interesting. Well, what I noted in that little montage that we played earlier is the August pro question 2 ads were talking about having a proven record for helping students in underperforming districts, and that was one of their arguments in favor of charter school expansion. But let's play a clip from the latest pro question 2 ad. This is from Great Schools Massachusetts.
32,000 kids want to go to a public charter school, but they can't. If you like your public school, Question 2 won't affect you. But for kids stuck in failing school districts, Question 2 will let parents choose something better.
Different tactic here.
Yeah, this is the liberal guilt gambit. I think that, you know, they're saying basically, why wouldn't you let these kids, these deserving kids, underserved, have what you have? And I think one of the reasons might be that the early ads were saying exactly opposite things, as we heard. You know, one said it's more money if we have charter schools. The other one, which is funded by the teachers' unions, say we'll have less money. So they sort of canceled each other out. So both of them have changed tactics slightly. And I think the liberal vote tends to reflexively go toward supporting public schools. And I think what they're trying to do is to say, you know what, you're liberal, give a little of what you have to other people who need it.
Yeah. Interesting, because a WBUR poll out today found that 52% of polled Massachusetts voters oppose question two. Support for charters, meanwhile, has stayed at 41%. Let's listen to a clip from the latest ad in opposition to question two. This is from Save Our Public Schools.
The outside corporate interests bankrolling question two are trying to deceive you. Here's the truth. Every time a new charter school opens, it drains money from the existing public schools. That's $400 million just last year, according to the state's own data.
So this is the I hate New York gambit. And basically what they're saying is these people are coming in from the outside to influence what is the most local issue of all, which is public schools. And I think that they're playing up the outside influence because it works with people. One question is, why do hedge fund managers want to get involved in this in the first place? There are tremendously lucrative tax breaks if you invest in charter schools. And you can double your money in 7 years, according to one analysis. So they have a real financial interest in more charter schools because it's more investment opportunities for them.
You know, I do think it's a little rich, though, pointing to the outside money influence, because on the opponents to question two side, a lot of their money is coming from national level teachers unions.
That's true, but at least it's transparent. When you see the disclaimer at the end, you know it's the teachers funding the anti-expansion forces. On the other side, there's six front groups that you have no idea of who they are, and that's why they're front groups, because they want to hide actually their real identity.
Not to say that the teachers unions haven't done something similar before. Do you remember back in 2013 during the Boston mayoral race where there was a super PAC called One Boston, and it launched a $500,000 ad in favor of Marty Walsh?
Right.
And
right.
We only found out later after Walsh won that that was actually $500,000 from the American Federation of Teachers, and they funneled it through that nonprofit.
That's how you play the game, you know, try to hide your identity so people don't know your agenda.
Okay, so let's talk about the overall money being spent here. $18.5 million just on question two. I mean, how does that compare to other ballot questions we've seen in Massachusetts?
It's a staggering amount of money. And one of the sort of trends that we've seen in the past is whoever spends more on a ballot question tends to win. So this one might be a reversal of that. But it's an amazing amount of money to pour into a one state over one issue. You usually see significant amounts in a lot of these ballot questions, but not money like that.
Well, let's move on to question four now. Of course, that's the question about legalizing recreational marijuana in Massachusetts. Just yesterday, opponents of question four, Campaign for a Safe and Healthy Massachusetts, launched their very first ad. Here's a taste of it.
In pro-pot states, incidents of drugged driving and fatal car accidents are up. More pot shops than McDonald's and Starbucks combined. Higher potency, dangerous drivers.
So that's the first ad from opponents to question four. Meanwhile, on the pro side, the Massachusetts Marijuana Initiative, their latest ad features a physician, Dr. Susan Lucas.
Right now, doctors and patients are afraid to bring up all treatment options for fear of breaking the law. Yes on four means we can regulate, tax, and legalize marijuana to help people with pain avoid opiates.
So what tactics here, John?
Well, I think the fear tactic on the anti side is pretty clear. And, you know, some of these ads are going to send the fact checkers to a chiropractor because, you know, basically you have statistics on both sides that can prove virtually anything. So they're going for the fear factor. Interestingly, the pro-marijuana people are going for the sort of institutional authority factor. So they've got a doctor from the medical community. Their earlier ad had a retired law enforcement official, a retired cop. So they're trying to put this sort of veneer of authority and official stamp of approval on their side of the campaign, while the others are just basically fear-mongering.
Right, but it's interesting because the yes people chose a doctor, but most, if not all, medical associations in Massachusetts have come out in opposition to question four.
So you figured something out about advertising, haven't you?
The scales are starting to fall from my eyes here, John. But let me ask you, this is advertising about ballot questions, about questions and issues. It's not advertising about individuals, you know, as in a presidential campaign. So what sale are they trying to make here? Are they trying to get people to the polls? Are they trying to shore up the base? Like, what are they actually trying to accomplish with these ads?
They're basically boiling it down to yes on four, no on four. I mean, that's what they want. All they want is the bottom line and any way they can get there. So people will go in with varying degrees of information and understanding of these ballot questions. questions, but a lot of it is just their gut instinct. A lot of it is just trying to reinforce what you already feel.
Okay, and how effective are these ads then at doing that? I mean, who usually wins the air war?
The one with the biggest megaphone, whoever spends the most money.
Well, John Carroll is a professor of communication at Boston University and WBUR senior news analyst. He walked us through some of the latest advertising regarding the Massachusetts ballot questions. John, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, well, John talked about fact checkers having to visit a chiropractor. We've got a couple fact checkers with us right now. We're going to focus on question four. So to fact check both sides, we're joined by addiction psychiatrist Dr. Kevin Hill. He's the director of the Substance Abuse Consultation Service at McLean Hospital and author of Marijuana, the Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. Dr. Hill, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me on, Magda.
Also with us is WBUR's Martha Biebinger. She's been reporting for a long time about marijuana and on question four as well. Martha, it is great to have you as well.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what the question four ads are saying, and I want to play one here to get us started. Here's a clip from opponents of legalizing marijuana, the No on Four group.
Question four would allow thousands of pot shops and marijuana operators throughout Massachusetts in neighborhoods like yours.
Okay, so Dr. Hill and Martha, fact check us on that. If question four passes, would we see thousands of operators across the state?
Can I start with that number, Kevin? Because I don't know how you get to thousands. The question says that towns would have to allow 20% of the retail licenses. So take Boston, 320 retail licenses, 20%, 64-ish. You add the medical marijuana dispensaries. I'm not sure that we're going to see that kind of proliferation. So, John, maybe we're back to your sort of scare tactics idea there a little bit. But there isn't cities and towns do have to allow them unless there's a local vote.
Absolutely.
Correct?
So we saw the same type of idea with the medical marijuana campaign, fear that there would be medical marijuana dispensaries in every community. And several communities have fought them tooth and nail. So I do think that number seems outrageous. Mm,
but Martha, as you said, the ballot question is an opt-out question.
That's
for cities and towns, not an opt-in one.
Yes, and that WBUR poll that was out, you mentioned, Magna, showed that 60% of respondents said they would not be bothered by having a store in their neighborhood. So it seems like the hurdle for town managers or mayors to cross if they want to secure a vote to ban the stores would be difficult.
Hmm. Well, let's listen to a clip from the group that's supporting marijuana legalization, Yes on Four.
It will tax and regulate marijuana for adults 21 and over, bringing millions in revenue for schools or law enforcement.
Okay, so how much would question four tax, and will we see the millions?
Well, you would see millions, but unfortunately, you're not going to see as much as you possibly could. In the other states that have legalized recreational marijuana, the effective tax rate, adding up all the taxes, essentially from 25 to 44%, and what the current ballot initiative proposes is an effective tax rate of 12%, so less than half of any other state. So you'd leave a considerable amount of money on the table. In Colorado in 2015, they raised $125 million or so. So if you base it upon that type of math, we're talking about leaving $70 million or so on the table with that effective tax rate.
The estimate here is $100 million in the third year of legal marijuana. So that's, if you break it down by the state sales tax, it's $63 million to the state. $37 million or so would go to this new entity that would be regulating marijuana. And just about $2 million to cities and towns. So that's $2 million across the whole state.
Interesting. So the vast bulk of it going to the state coffers then.
Mm-hmm, through the sales tax.
Earmarked for anything?
Not at this point, but that's to be determined.
Okay. Now, there's also questions about how it would be taxed. Would it be taxed by weight, by THC concentration? What do we know about that?
Yeah, wholesale.
So Colorado is figuring that out as we go, and I think they've done a reasonable job, certainly. But the current 24-page ballot initiative does not get that specific as to how taxation would occur. And I think that would be one of the many issues that would fall under the auspices of the Cannabis Control Commission.
I might just add, Kevin, you know this, that the folks who put the 12% in say the reason they wanted it to be on the lower side was because they didn't want to, they wanted to be roughly in line with the black market price. They didn't want there to be a big difference so that people would keep buying on the black market.
Well, I think that the black market issue is one of the distorted issues of this campaign, unfortunately. The pro folks will say that they're trying to, quote, eliminate, unquote, the black market. You're never going to do that. There's always going to be a black market there. You will definitely reduce it dramatically when you legalize an illegal substance. And then on the other side, the anti-marijuana people talk about a thriving black market in Colorado, and that's not the case either. So they have dramatically reduced the black market in Colorado, but again, there's always going to be somebody selling something different or cheaper. So the tax rate being low is really not a strong reason, you know, to try to curb that black market or eliminate it. It's not a reasonable expectation.
Mm. Well, let's hear another clip from advertising from opponents to question four, talking about what they believe are some of the potential consequences of legalization.
In pro-pot states, incidents of drugged driving and fatal car accidents are up.
Okay, so this is one I'm really wondering. Is it true and how do we know?
Well, what they're talking about are accidents that have people involved in them that have a positive marijuana tox screen. And so it's interesting. That's one of the issues that they also use to talk about the difficulties that law enforcement will face. So in Colorado, they use a blood test more often than not, and the anti-people will talk about the lack of a breathalyzer. So that's a challenge. I think that what we all know is that the current methods for evaluating driving under the influence of cannabis are not good. So therefore, when you look at the Colorado data, you know, that's not necessarily saying that the cannabis has caused those accidents. It just so happens that those folks have marijuana in their system.
Yeah, I think that's a AAA study. Well, there is a AAA study out of Washington that shows the doubling of fatal accidents, but they don't know which driver caused the accident. Uh-huh. They don't know how much THC was in the person's
it's
system.
It's someone involved in the accident.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a little, it's squishy, I would say. There is a fact sheet from the National Highway Safety Transportation Office that says the research on increased risk when you are using marijuana is mixed. That it's not really clear. But I think that goes back to Kevin's point about the difficulty of measuring just what's happening to you when you're driving and you've smoked or ingested weed.
Yeah, I think that's a legitimate point to be concerned about. Clearly, that you know, law enforcement won't have the technology that we'd like them to have in this case. But in other states that have done this, they've done a reasonable job of trying to do the best they can with the available technology.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about what question four does state about keeping marijuana out of the hands of those under 21. Here's a clip from advertising for from a group supporting question four.
Question four requires strict product labeling and childproof packaging and bans advertising directed at kids.
All right, fact check that one. Is it an accurate statement?
It could be. So in the 24-page ballot initiative, that leaves that issue of advertising to the Cannabis Control Commission. So I think there are plenty of places in the ballot initiative where there isn't the level of detail that people are comfortable with. I mean, it's a great first draft, but how much of that are you going to clean up? And I think that's one of the areas. It is addressed. Advertising's addressed, packaging's addressed, but perhaps not to the level that we need it to be.
And it would be up to the commission to address it or to provide greater guidance and detail.
Yeah, they say the implication is that they'll piggyback on some of the regs that have been drafted to control medical marijuana, which does not allow products that look like candy, but look like candy is kind of vague.
Right.
Right.
Okay. And remind us, who does the ballot question say? Who would appoint the commission? How many members would be on the Cannabis Commission?
So the treasurer appoints the three-member Cannabis Control Commission, and I believe there'll be a 15-member advisory board as well that's appointed by the governor.
It's okay. Quite a lot of power in the hands of three people.
Three people for the whole state. All right. There's one other fact or assertion that I want to check with both of you. This doesn't come from advertising. Instead, it comes from the debate that WBUR UMass Boston and the Boston Globe hosted about ballot question four, and it has to do with contention over teen use in states where marijuana has been legalized. So in this clip from our debate, you're going to hear Jim Borgasani, he's communications director for Yes on Four, and State Senator Jason Lewis from the No on Four camp, and they tussled over this question of teen use. The clip starts with Jim Borgasani.
In Colorado, the Healthy Kids Colorado survey, teen use is absolutely flat since legalization. We have not seen teen use increase in any other state. In fact, nationally, despite 27 states having medical marijuana, we've seen teen use continually decline since 1997.
That's completely misleading.
That's not misleading at all. We have seen teen use decline.
Josh, may I respond to that?
I want to move on to another.
That's completely misleading. In fact, federal data, which tracks usage across all states, showed a 12% increase since legalization in Colorado. And even
that's
if you put
true,
aside
Jason.
Dueling
that
studies, even if you want to put aside dueling studies, I ask you to, what does your common sense tell you?
Okay, so you heard there State Senator Jason Lewis and Jim Borgasani presenting a couple of different numbers, a set of numbers from the Healthy Kids Colorado survey from the Colorado Department of Public Health, I believe, and some federal numbers as well. So what's the truth here? What are actual rates of teen use in Colorado post-legalization?
I think this is a really complex issue, and certainly we want to see more data on it. But given the data that you're referring to, I think that the pro folks are right on this one. Use among kids has been flat in the United States. The two data sets that you're talking about, the one that the anti group talks about is from the high intensity drug trafficking area. They talk about an increase, but it's not a statistically significant increase. You know, there, it has to do with the fact that it's a small sample size and within the margin for error. You know, that type of thing says that it's really not a statistically significant increase, whereas the Healthy Kids survey that you mentioned, which has a much larger sample size and is also the data that the state of Colorado actually relies upon more heavily and believes is more accurate, says that use is flat.
I might just add that even when you look at that national survey that Kevin just mentioned and you were talking about, Meghna, in Washington, it's flat. In Colorado, it's up a little bit, although the Department of Public Health doesn't say it's statistically significant. The opponents will say if you dig in, if you look at the places where there are the highest concentration of stores, you see higher rates, but that's their interpretation. That's not anything that's been proven. I think a lot of people do wrestle with Jason Lewis's last comment, though. It kind of goes against what we would expect to have happened. And so people think that maybe we just don't know enough yet about the effects.
We want to know more, but I think this also underscores the importance of really listening to the evidence. I mean, that's why we do the science, right? You have to test hypotheses rigorously, and then you have to live with the results. Sometimes the answers aren't what you expect. And I think that the answers with these policies really say that these policies themselves are not the reason that some kids end up using marijuana.
There's an underlying issue there,
there
that, that leads them to use. Well, Dr. Kevin Hill is a director of the Substance Abuse Consultation Service at McLean Hospital and author of Marijuana, The Unbiased Truth About the World's Most Popular Weed. Dr. Hill, thank you so very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And Martha Biebinger is WBUR's health reporter. Martha, thank you so much. Your reporting has helped us help keep us straight here as we head towards November. Thank you so much. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Regardless of who wins the presidential election on November 8th, there's a lot of soul-searching already going on. Republicans are asking themselves, what is the GOP in the age of Trumpism? But leading Democrats are also asking themselves a similar question, especially given the white working-class voters who've moved so strongly towards Donald Trump. David Shribman puts the question simply. Have the Democrats replaced the Republicans as the party of the social, cultural, and economic elite? Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He recently wrote in the Boston Globe about major changes in the Democratic Party, and he joins us now from Pittsburgh. David Shribman, great to have you back on the show.
Nice to talk to you also.
So first of all, let's start off with the example that you you lead with in your Globe article about looking at West Virginia and how that's changed for the Democrats in the past several election cycles. How has it changed?
Well, gosh, West Virginia was so dependably Democratic that our own governor, Michael Dukakis, won it by a substantial and very easy margin in 1988. Then you go back to the next Massachusetts governor to run for president, Mitt Romney, and he won it even easier, and he was a Republican. He won, in fact, every one of the 55 counties in West Virginia. So you had a swing from one Massachusetts governor in 88 to the next one in 2012, a huge swing. And now it is West Virginia is so desperately eager to be in the Republican camp that Hillary Clinton won't make any stops there, none.
And so what's, I mean, therein lies the question. Like, what has driven that swing? Is it Republicans embracing the concerns and needs of those working class voters, or is it Democrats abandoning them?
Well, there are two things going on. One is peculiar to West Virginia, and that's guns and coal. There are no guns. There's no coal, for example, in Massachusetts. Not a factor there. But the war on coal, as they put it there, is Democrats searching for environmental solutions to the energy crisis, and they have basically left coal in West Virginia behind. So that's a West Virginia peculiarity. But West Virginia is not the only place where this is happening. It's just a particularly good one for us because of the Massachusetts governors. The fact is that some places with heavy amounts of blue-collar voters are going to vote for Trump, and those are the people that Franklin Roosevelt brought into the party in 1932, introduced them to the party in 32, and they were sealed by 36. And now we're seeing them kind of flitting in a different direction. We've seen a little bit of that in the past, in 1980, with those Reagan Democrats. But this is a mass movement that should be very troubling to the Democrats as they begin to think about their identity post-election.
Well, I mean, as you write in your Globe piece, this group of voters, this constituency, I mean, as you just mentioned, for generations has been part of the core identity of the party. So what are the Democrats if they are not the party of working class Americans?
Well, the Democrats are the party of women who have jobs and professions. They're the party of professionals on the two coasts and of university liberals and of minorities. And that's not the party that Franklin Roosevelt put together. Of course, he did have his brain trust, and it was Harvard-oriented. But basically, the kind of people whom we described as the elite of the 50s and 60s were Republicans. This is a different era with a different kind of elite, and the elites now are in the Democratic Party.
Huh. David Tribman, let's talk about whether or not all Democrats see this as a problem, because you talked to so many people that you quoted in your Boston Globe article, and the variety of opinion is quite striking. I feel like there are a lot of Democrats who say, that's just fine with us if we lose white working class voters.
Yes, a lot of Democrats and a lot of important Democrats feel that way. One of them is James Carville, whom you remember, the raging Cajun from
yep.
Louisiana, who was basically the brain trust behind the Clinton ascendancy in 1992. His argument is this: we traded West Virginia for New Jersey, and that's a good choice. That's a good trade. That's kind of like what the Yankees did in getting Babe Ruth in 1918. That's a good trade. A lot of Democrats feel that way. A lot of Democratic moderates feel that way, not only liberals. And so there's a tension here. The labor movement is apoplectic about this. They feel comfortable in the Democratic, labor leaders feel comfortable in the Democratic coalition, and they worry about how many of their folks are drifting into the Trump camp.
Huh. Now, it's interesting because, I mean, so you mentioned James Carville. You also had this, what I thought was a rather stunning quote from Will Marshall. He's president and founder of the Progressive Policy Institute. Was very close to the Clintons as well, and he says that he told you that the party's emphasis should be on college education, suburban moderates, and he kind of looked at it from an electoral or political perspective rather than one of governing and policy. Because the quote that you have is Will Marshall saying, that the swing voters who hold the balance of power in key battleground states aren't particularly angry and don't see the economy as rigged against them. They give priority to growth over fairness and are more inclined to help U.S. businesses succeed than to punish them. Now,
If you take that phrase, preference for growth over fairness.
Yes, that's the one that really caught my attention.
Doesn't that really describe the Republicans of another era?
I was wondering, which Democrat is this exactly?
That's right. I mean, that describes precisely the Reagan outlook, don't you think?
I do. And so let me ask you, if we have, you know, a Democratic insider like Marshall saying we should go for exactly these voters who look for growth over fairness, and the subtext there is these are the voters who have benefited from the growth, so maybe
yes.
They're not so worried about fairness. I mean, does that really mean that this is the wing of the Democratic Party, despite the strength of the Sanders campaign, despite the popularity of Elizabeth Warren, despite that opposite wing, that the Will Marshalls of the world say, don't worry about it, we got to stick with the power elite?
Well, a lot of them are saying that, and that really does trouble the people you mentioned earlier, of course, Senator Sanders, Senator Warren. It troubles them, and it really is at odds with the history, or at least the contemporary history of the Democratic Party. Now, think back, really, about who the Republicans used to be. The Republicans used to be the party of liberation. They were the party of industrialization. Now they're the party, not so much, right?
Hmm. Well, so let's talk about the other wing, because I'm calling them wings. I mean, I'm sure it's more like a hodgepodge. But because, you know, you did talk to people who said, OK, well, you could focus on the coastal educated elite, or you could also take a look at, you know, the energy that drove Bernie Sanders' campaigns. You could take a look at millennials and the fact that they are very much interested in fairness. You could take a look at those people who support Elizabeth Warren. You could take a look at working class voters, both white and minority voters, who still stick with the Democratic Party. You know, how is the party going to reflect their interests if they're going to make a lasting coalition?
Well, that's why they're going to have, no matter what happens in this election. But presume for a second that Secretary Clinton wins this election. They're going to have a huge question about what kind of president she's going to be. Is she going to be the president of Wall Street and Goldman Sachs? Is she going to be the president of the AFL-CIO and of Elizabeth Warren? Is she going to be the president of Will Marshall? What is she going to be? Of course, we've only had 44 presidents, and they're all different. And she'll, of course, have her own agenda and her own identity, because she has her own identity and her own character now. But there's going to be a huge fight within this party about who they are in the future. Mrs. Clinton will have a huge voice in that if she wins. But still, there are a lot of people on the two wings, as you put it, who are going to have something to say about it, and particularly since a lot of those people are very, very young and they're the future of the party.
So can you have, I mean, you quoted William Daley, right? Son of former mayor of Chicago, former Chicago mayor Daley.
He's the son of a mayor and the brother of a mayor.
And the brother of a mayor, right. And he told you that we have even more left, an even more left Democratic Party, more diverse, watching government in action after so much inaction. And I'm wondering, In the long run, are these two impulses competing within the Democratic Party? Can they coexist? Can you have the economically progressive party of Bernie Sanders, you know, live alongside the concentration or of the power elite that Will Marshall is looking after? Or ultimately, is there going to be a split there?
Well, sure you can. Think back into the Roosevelt years when you had basically you had Northeastern and urban liberals coexisting in a party, not easily, but coexisting nonetheless in a party with Southern segregationists. And we all grew up with that party. That party was the party that Lyndon Johnson tried to bring to heel. He had to get the votes of Republicans to get that Civil Rights Bill in 64 and the Voting Rights Bill in 65, because the rump of his party that was situated in his own region, the South, was simply not going to go along with the Civil Rights Bill. So you've had those kind of tensions in the Democratic Party before. They were different tensions, to be sure, but the party is, you know, big parties have big dissensions. Little parties have a lot of unity, but no power.
You know, you quote Todd Gitlin, a Columbia University sociologist, who told you that he was startled by the fact that the Democrats are hardly competing for the people that Donald Trump is claiming. And then to swing back to a former Massachusetts governor that you talked about earlier, Michael Dukakis, he told you that, quote, we have badly neglected the work we should have been doing for blue-collar working folks. These are our people, and they have no business voting for a Republican, but you've got to take care of people and pay attention to them. I mean, I'm just wondering, is the Democratic Party now moving in a direction where Michael Dukakis' view is no longer going to hold that much sway? Is the party basically saying we can live without white working class voters?
Well, what's interesting about those two quotes, which appeared in different parts of that piece, is that Michael Dukakis is basically the personification of the mainstream Democratic Party of the late 20th century. You think of him as a student body president, right? You can imagine him at Brookline High School as the president of his class. Todd Gitlin was the second president of the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, the most radical student group of that same period or slightly later. And you have guys like that who have little in common in their background expressing the same concern. Meanwhile, you've got Will Marshall saying something completely different. It is a recipe for a huge fight.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, I mean, you've been following elections for a long, long time. I'm just wondering, was this sort of reckoning for the Democrats? It seems like it was a long time coming, and we're just sort of we're seeing it erupt now, but the pieces have been laid for some time.
Oh, I think so. I remember as a young person looking at the reading about the people who went to McGovern's convention in 1972 and the number of PhDs who were there, the percentage of PhDs, and it was astonishing. And so for the party has been moving toward a party of PhDs, university professionals, university liberals, and, of course, the ascension of active women in politics is, who have really drifted into the Democratic Party or found voice in the Democratic Party have really reinforced that impulse. I think you're right. It's been a long time coming.
Now, what does this reckoning mean that it's happening amongst the Democrats? At the same time, there's that parallel reckoning going on with the GOP.
Well, I'll tell you who this is really good for. It's really good for the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard because they love to have conferences about the future of the party and what went wrong. And so a lot of people are wringing their hands, but I bet you people on JFK Boulevard in Cambridge are really happy about this because there are two great conferences almost certainly being drafted right now.
And I'm sure all those white working class voters are saying, yeah, exactly what we need, more white papers and more conferences.
From the Kennedy School at Harvard.
Exactly. Well, David Shribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. His recent op-ed in the Globe was titled Democrats, the Party of the Professional Class. We've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. David Shribman, it is always so great to talk with you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I look forward to doing it again.
And listeners, we want to remind you that WBUR will be broadcasting the final presidential debate tonight at 9 o'clock. And while you listen, you can visit WBUR.org for a live fact check of the candidates' claims powered by NPR reporters and editors. That's at WBUR.org starting at 9 o'clock tonight. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to spend the rest of the hour with a singular voice on public radio. He's also one of my favorites, Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Jack is the author of a number of books. His latest is The Lost History of 1914, How the Great War Was Not Inevitable. But Jack's newest work is something different. It's a play called The Battle Not Begun, Munich, 1938, and it will be performed this Saturday at Black Box Lab at the Community House in Hamilton. And Jack joins us now. Jack Beatty, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you, Meghna, for your generosity. I'm just delighted to be with you.
It's great to have you, and I'm glad that Tom Mashbrook and the On Point crew let us borrow you for a little bit today. Well, let me just first start by asking you, I mean, your last book was 1914, about the dawn of the Great War. Was 1938 a natural next place for you in terms of historical exploration?
Well, yes, in that A.J.P. Taylor, the British historian, said that if in history you can say that one event caused another, as you can say in physics, for example, that one thing caused another, you can say that World War I caused World War II. And therefore, it's my interest in 1938 and in how the Second World War began is of a piece with the curiosity that led me to 1914.
Yeah. And I mean, specifically the Munich Agreement, because it is such an iconic moment, right? What was it about Munich and the aftermath of that that made you think, this is where I want to focus right now?
Well, I've sort of grown up haunted by Munich. It has been cited as a cautionary tale by interventionists and hawks in every American conflict and even crisis since 1945. It is the regnant metaphor in foreign policy. There are very few. This one is, and basically, this says, if you don't stop aggression in one place, it'll go someplace else. It'll get even worse down the line. Here is Lyndon Johnson, for example, saying, "Everything I knew about history told me that if I got out of Vietnam and let Ho Chi Minh run through the streets of Saigon, I'd be doing what Chamberlain did in World War II. I would be seen as a coward and my nation as an appeaser." The variants of that argument have justified American wars ever since, and even before Korea. So I, as one opposed to almost all of those interventions, I have reckoned with Munich on and off, and I proposed writing a book about the metaphor and really looking at it. But then it had been done very well by others. But then I got interested in the conference itself, and I wondered, was Munich a Munich? That is, was Munich as bad as everybody says? The British had the strong hand, that they should have stood up to Hitler. They failed to do so. He was encouraged next year to invade Poland, and the Second World War ensued. Is there truth to that? And what I discovered when I went back and looked at the cabinet meetings, looked at the books, the biographies, and so on, is increasingly scholars say no, there isn't truth to that. Chamberlain had a very limited hand. He dealt the best hand he could, and he put off war for a year. Now, some people say that was a disaster because in the meantime, Soviet Russia, which had been part of the coalition in 1938, yeah. signed a pact, non-aggression pact with Hitler. But on the other hand, if you're a Chamberlain and the Joint Chiefs of Staff there say war now would be suicide, Prime Minister, you're not going to go to war over a few German-speaking people in Czechoslovakia.
Well, Jack. So I want to come back to Neville Chamberlain here in a second, but just for people who don't remember this moment in history, so the Munich talks were between Adolf Hitler and Neville Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Great Britain, and the discussion was about the fate of Czechoslovakia, right?
Yes. Yes, Czechoslovakia had, it was cobbled together in 1918, 1919, out of the shards of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And you had Slovaks, you had Czechs, you had Ruthenes, you had Poles, you had Hungarians, and you had up along the German border and around the Austrian border, a German-speaking Sudeten, that is South German speakers. And the Sudeten Germans, 3 million out of a population of 9 million, so they were a substantial part of the Czech population, Hitler funded a Nazi party there. It agitated for autonomy within the Czechoslovak state. The Czechoslovak state, Prague, said, sure, you can have the autonomy. And then Hitler provoked violence there. This is all in the summer of 1938. And instead of autonomy within Czechoslovakia, the new goal was annexation by Germany, the Sudeten Germans to go home. As Chamberlain's cab driver put it to him, we can't very well go to war, sir, to stop Germans returning to Germany now, can we? And that was a pretty powerful argument. They seemed to want to return to Germany. And Chamberlain's view was, well, my gosh, this Czechoslovakia, this was put together, this is a Woodrow Wilson project, a kind of triumph of idealism over geography and history. And he wholly sympathized with German complaints against the Versailles Treaty. So he was more than willing to say, yes, you can have the Sudeten Germans if that's what you want, and to silence Prague, to say, basically, if you don't go for this, you're on your own. You have to fight Germany on your own.
And yet a year later, Europe was at war. I mean, so you've turned this into a play, right? You've turned these talks that happened between Hitler and Chamberlain into a play based on history, but of course fictionalized because it's for the stage. So, I mean, I want to talk with you a little bit more about how you render Neville Chamberlain, because honestly, he's a rather infamous figure in history now, as you said a little earlier. So I want to play a bit of archival tape from the moment which I think Chamberlain goes down in history as. It's that infamous moment where he is landed back in Great Britain and he's waving that piece of paper.
We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
But of course, how wrong he was. I mean, Jack, here's a man who is almost literally, in our historical memory now, defined by that one word you used earlier, appeasement.
Yes.
So how is it that you got into his head? I mean, how did you put him onto the stage? What Neville Chamberlain did you find on stage?
Well, I tried to answer this question. Why did he want peace? And the other question I wanted to answer was, why did Hitler want war? And the answers aren't obvious in either case. And my Chamberlain, and I think to a certain extent, to a large extent, the Chamberlain of history, wanted peace because he saw war, modern warfare, as uniquely destructive, and to him, destructive of the beauties, the tenuous pastoral idol of England. And I have him in a speech to the House of Commons basically say, here is what is at stake. And he talks about the beauties of an English sunset, the smell of hay in the fields, the chiming of church bells. And he had this view that this is all to be destroyed by the German Air Force if we have a war. And nothing could be worth seeing that destroyed. And he had a vastly overestimated view of what the Germans could do in the air. His chiefs said to him, there'll be 600,000 dead within 6 months. Well, in the whole 6 years, there were only 60,000 British civilians killed. So the chiefs were off by a factor of 10. Huh. But that's what was in his mind.
Well, but Jack, I wonder if I just can jump in here for a second, because Chamberlain actually died not long after the Munich Agreement, right? He died in 1940.
Yes.
And just weeks before he died, we found this quote that he had written, that Chamberlain wrote, "On the whole, although I have, in a sense, failed in everything I set out to achieve, I do not believe that history will blame me for that, and I don't regard my public life as a failure."
Yes.
I mean, after having written this play, do you regard his public life as a failure or not?
I do not. He was right to make his deal with Hitler. He was wrong and a fool to think that this slip of paper he had Hitler sign, which was apart from the Munich Agreement on Czechoslovakia, the slip of paper that just said, "Oh, we're going to love each other forever, you Britain," and he thought that was the trophy of Munich, and it was meaningless, of course. So he was a fool for peace. But, I'm just reading A.J.P. Taylor. He says, basically, the weapons that got Britain through the war, and certainly the Battle of Britain, Hurricanes and Spitfire planes, that was under Chamberlain. That buildup was, both as Chancellor of the Exchequer and as Prime Minister. He played the card. I don't see him as an utter failure, and neither do historians today, I think.
Well, Jack, so we should talk about, of course, the other man, Adolf Hitler. You wrote he's a major part of the play as well. What was it like getting into Hitler's head and creating a Hitler for the stage?
Well, it was a frightening experience. You're afraid of being infected by him. And yet, at the same time, you've got to create a character. You've got to have imaginative sympathy. That is, you've got to get inside and make him explicable to the audience. And what I try to show is why it was he wanted a war. And in this long monologue he has with Mussolini, he ties in his experience in 1914 and the First World War to essentially what he wanted in 1938. And it comes out that the only time in his life he felt significant, he felt valued, he felt at home in the world, were those 4 wretched years, we would think, in the trenches.
Wow.
But somehow the war, the destruction, corresponded to something inside him, and he could feel at home there, and he wanted that for the whole world.
Jack, let me ask you, we've got just a couple seconds here left to go. You've written this play about 1938, but you're putting it on before a 2016 audience, right?
Yes.
In the throes of an election that makes me have to take a deep breath every now and then. I mean, your thoughts about today's audience seeing this?
Well, you know, you can't help but, you know, pick up the newspaper and people make comparison. They call Donald Trump a fascist. I don't think that's true. But there's much about him that's very disturbing in terms of his rejection of democratic norms. Hitler had no use for democracy. And I'm not sure that Donald Trump has a great deal of value for it. After all, he wanted to jail his opponent if he wins.
Well, that's On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. His latest work is a play called The Battle Not Begun, Munich, 1938. There will be a staged reading of it this Saturday at 7:30 at Black Box Lab at the Community House in Hamilton. We've got more information at our website, radioboston.org. Jack, congratulations on the new play, and it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna. I really appreciate it.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.